Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Frances Sachs, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm joined by Elizabeth During, author of The Chastity Plot. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me.
Sure. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about your background and how this book came into being.
Good question. I think that it's, asking about the fate of a book is asking about a very, tangled history. How do you find your way to a book, or how does a book find its way to you? For me, it's probably, connected with my own background. I come from background in feminist theory, but also in theology. So I've had, an education in theology, philosophy, and religion. But this book is more looking at chastity from a variety of cultural associations. So certainly the religious plays, as one might expect, a very important role, but it's not primarily an intervention in the religious meanings of chastity. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And the part that I suppose makes sense to most people is the oddity of trying to find a positive reading of chastity. Because for many people within feminism, the cultural fuss about female virginity, the whole issue around purity, has not seemed a very attractive option. Indeed, many feminists thought, the way forward, the way towards, freedom, recognition, public life, was definitely away from this suppression of female sexual life. And that always had this connotation that, innocence, virginity, was sort of condescending toward women. It was certainly keeping women within, a much more, within a kind of enclosure, this idea that woman was intended to remain outside of the real active world of male action and participation, and that sexual restraint was counted as female honor, as opposed to, male military honor, even male intellectual achievement. That this recognition of a female value as connected to control of your sexuality was not exactly complimentary. And that provoked me. I was, curious as to the other history of chastity, where chastity was aligned with power, with a kind of spiritual power, but also a form of independence, a way of opting out of the more traditional plot for women's lives, which had to do with marriage, domesticity, child rearing. Yeah. So that's probably the beginning of it, the motivation.
So as someone who has worked in feminism, was chastity something that you also looked down upon as you went through your studies, or was there a moment where it kind of came to be something more interesting to you?
I think it's ambivalent. I can certainly see the role it played in female subordination, and this rather curious idea that the woman's body is at its most powerful, its most magical, its most admirable when it's untouchable, when it doesn't act at all, when it's passive, and that was provocative. That was certainly the poisonous side of chastity. But on the other hand, there's this tradition, which I know about from my background in theology, where chastity was a kind of a form of athletic achievement, a way of struggling against the body, a kind of ambition. And certainly the, initial role of chastity, of sexual renunciation among the early Christians in the first, 5 or 6 centuries, probably was more a a promise for male ascetics, for men who wanted to follow a more difficult and challenging path, who wanted to distinguish themselves from the norm and from the commonplace, and enter this competition for the higher rewards. And women were always part of it, but most of the exhortations to chastity in early Christianity were intended toward men. So that the different histories, the different gendered histories of chastity is certainly part of the story I wanted to tell.
So kind of true to its name, the plot,
mm-hmm.
the organization I found of the book itself follows a pretty neat and satisfying chronological path through the history of chastity. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping we could start kind of at the beginning, mm-hmm. maybe not the beginning of chastity period. I guess we don't really know in pre-antiquity practices, mm-hmm. but at the beginning of chastity that we know about. Can you talk about how it came to be?
Yeah, because there is something peculiar about this moment in late antiquity when Christianity is forming as a cult and as a new religion, and the way it did distinguish itself from pagan, from Greco-Roman morality and values. And this was certainly noticed, that the Christians were doing something different. It was highly valuable in all societies, Greek, Roman, Babylonian, Hebrew, for people to, have a certain restraint in their sexual lives. That was, there's always been a kind of valuation of modesty, of being able to control your erotic desires rather than having them control you. But the Christians added this other, this very strange aspiration to this idea of living as if you could be free from sexuality, free from marriage, no longer part of the game, which is to continue society, to keep the human race going, that they brought in this rather radical idea that maybe just bring it to an end. Maybe history is waiting for its exit clause. And that saying no to sex is also saying no to sexual reproduction. So this is the controversial part of early Christianity that kind of later praise of chastity has been rather nervous about. That, if you take it seriously, if you follow it to its conclusion, an embrace of sexual renunciation really does mean a kind of death to the species. And how can that be positively valued? So that provoked me. That was certainly, a very strange idea. So this transition from, late ancient ideals of moderation, right? Restraint, temperance, prudence, being rational in your life, gets rather strongly, transgressed and indeed violated by this new message, this message of total renunciation, and what that could mean for the human self. So that's the first moment, yeah.
Where did that transition come from? Why was that an appealing ideal to early Christians?
The kind of bias against sex wasn't exactly unique to the Christians. It existed in other ascetic communities and among, say the ancient, late ancient sage was somebody who could determine for themselves how they would live, and often lead a celibate life or a life of say restraint in eating and drinking, even in engaging in the kind of normal social activities, and concentrate on spiritual improvement. So this idea of withdrawal into the contemplative life, that was certainly pre-Christian. And the Christians, took that on board. They were able to absorb, this kind of rather beautiful idea of the purely contemplative self, and then add this twist, which I think did change the whole history of the chastity plot. Yeah. Mm. It's not per se part of the original teaching of Jesus. I mean, Jesus was a bachelor, and that was certainly, special to his calling and to those who joined him, that they left their homes, they, escaped from their families to follow this strange otherworldly ideal. And then it's as if they could just suspend their attachment to the family, to physicality, to life continuing as it was. So perhaps it was a very, apocalyptic message, that the world as it existed was kind of doomed to end, that there would be this breaking in of eternity into time, and that the, time would not necessarily last. So I think the turn against sexuality was, can't be looked at apart from the turn against marriage and the family. And I think early Christians, stood out as strange and as radical because they seemed to want to emancipate themselves from social continuation, to live in the light of a new world, a new dispensation, a new future.
So was sexuality central to Christian dogma at its inception, or was that something that early Christians kind of adopted in order to differentiate themselves from the Romans that were living so close?
Living amongst. I don't think it was, a dogma at all. I think it was part of these unusual practices of living in brotherhoods, and then sometimes living in sisterhood, brotherhoods, as if sexual difference didn't obtain, as if you could go beyond gender, and that was a pretty radical expectation. So a few, model careers of the monk, of the inhabitant of the desert, of those who went off to live either in tiny communities or to live in caves or just to wander, to lead a rather nomadic life, without settling down back into social communities. And that couldn't last. I mean, that was, an extreme but rather temporary moment in at least the life of the majority of Christians. It remained as a choice for the clergy, for those who were the elite, the exclusive, unusual people. But ordinary Christians, were going to go on marrying. They were going to be like ordinary Greeks and Romans. And so for them, this new teaching about the dispensability of sexuality had to be tempered. It had to be changed. So a lot of Christian doctrine, over the long period in which virginity was certainly considered, the highest vocation, had to mediate between these two pulls, towards the family, towards reproduction, towards perhaps giving a place to marriage, even ultimately making marriage a sacrament, and this other, otherworldly, uncanny ideal that you could, jump out of your skin, out of your reality, into some other place, and that was the place of the chaste, the kind of making a martyr of your own body, and what I call the eunuch, including all the negative implications of the eunuch. And the Greeks and Romans and the Jews at the time would have been horrified by this idea. To be a eunuch was definitely to be very low on the social ladder. So to make that valuable was provocative.
You said that the early Christian chastity was maybe even more associated with masculinity than it was with femininity. Mm-hmm. Were there any, is the idea of eunuch, is that a gendered term?
It certainly sounds it, doesn't it? So that, in making that kind of my term for the more ambitious, extreme form of chastity, I'm consciously, playing against our expectations of gender difference. What kind of body does the eunuch have? It doesn't seem to be, an attractive option for women. Some of the, more extreme dissident groups around late Judaism, around early Christianity, were suspected of practicing castration and of doing something, quite horrible to conventional ideas of gender identity. So the role for women in that would be, I suppose, to forgo maternity, to also embrace the idea that their significance was not as objects of sexual attention, not as intending to be, you know, perfect wives and mothers, but as understood and respected for their own sake. So then to become a eunuch is almost like a third sex, you know, someplace in between and outside of conventions of gender identity. And that was embraced by women. Women who were attracted to Christianity and kind of saw the point of this, you know, found it a reason to, like, you know, tear up their marriage contracts, to break out of engagements that had been imposed on them by their families, to live, say, with other women, even, you know, most radically, to follow around, you know, sort of male spiritual leaders, to form their own communities and own separate ways of living. So this was certainly taken up by women very quickly. And so the church had to find a place for this. And it was troubling. You know, there was the idea that women who were allowed this exemption from the normal, you know, destiny of women, were claiming to be equals, and were challenging even their teachers and their spiritual advisors in that they could live as if they were men, and as if they were men who had a special exemption from society. Mm. So the virgin probably is a term that for quite a while didn't have, you know, a strict gender connotation. Men were called virgins. You know, the 40,000 men, the 40,000 virgins who would, you know, inaugurate the new and final, you know, age, like the age when Revelation was really actualized, were probably supposed to be men. But then groups of virgins were also idealized in that way. And families who were disgruntled that their daughters, you know, or sisters or wives were, you know, breaking out, were told that this is something to be proud of rather than you know, going to complain. And there were plenty of court cases where Christian leaders had to, you know, face judges who said, you know, you have you know, you owe something back to these families. You have stolen these women from them. So that was a very interesting time in early Christianity when the battle between the Christian life and the family, between this kind of otherworldly and you know, it's almost end of history expectation, was definitely at war with society.
The idea of virgin as something that was kind of androgynous, more of a singular, even more of a intense concept, faded from the popular imagination, and it became something that was more gendered.
Mm-hmm.
How did that shift? And I think you talk about that as the shift from the eunuch plot to the maiden plot.
Mm-hmm.
What was that shift?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question. And I can see how it also picks up, you know, some of the kind of more utopian expectations we might have today of the non-binary position as a kind of antisocial and more self-determined way of life, and, you know, similarly challenging to conventional ideas of gender. But there was always compromise. I mean, you don't have innovation, you don't have provocation without, you know, kickback, without a backlash. And the, you know, the prevalence of, you know, other models of especially female sexual virtue were there to kind of serve as means to this new compromise, or means to the, you know, the compromise that probably did went out. One of the things that I suppose didn't figure very much in the Christian struggle over this extreme concept of, you know, androgynous or non-binary virginity was the, you know, that part of Greek mythology and possibly other you know, religious traditions, which did allow a place for those who followed, say, in Greece, the cult of Diana, the cult of Artemis, in the original, who's a figure for the wild. I mean, Artemis lives in the woods. You know, she got an exemption, you know, from you know, her father Zeus, not to marry, to live as a virgin, to allow no man access to her and to her followers. And that very strong, very kind of untamed notion of the maiden who remains a maiden, and she was called a maiden, you know, then kind of got a sort of transformation in Christian practice to being, you know, the exemplary woman who is sort of, you know, not as subject to libidinous desire as men, and therefore can be almost a wedge within her own society, representing a different kind of purity. Because I think in before Christianity, it was certainly women who were considered, you know, the more violently erotic, you know, the least in control of their sexual desires, the seducers. You know, men were more rational. So if they thought, well, you know, let's not go overboard, this was possible for them. But it was, you know, quite unusual to imagine that women had an independence of that type and had, you know, a kind of intellectual power and spiritual ambition of that type. So I think it did have to be controlled. And this other ideal of the maiden as modest, as virtuous, as self-controlled, you know, came in there to fill the gap, and then acquired its own series of romances and idealizations and, you know, beautiful pictures. I mean, you need a pretty picture if you're going to convince people to, you know, behave morally, you know, whatever you mean by that.
It's interesting that idea of chastity was kind of responsible for shifting an understanding of women's sexuality from being something that was uncontrollable in ancient Greek time period into something that it kind of naturalized the idea that women are more like demure and don't have sexual appetites.
How you convince people of that? It's an interesting story. It both, you know, led to this idea, especially in the 19th century, a kind of European ideal, and perhaps in many other places, that it was easier for women to exercise restraint, and therefore their modesty was valuable, and they would be the leaders in any campaign of reform, rehabilitation, protection of the family, protection of children, you know, fight against sexual crimes, against promiscuity, against commercial sex. So women get, you know, almost solicited into representing this and representing a kind of, you know, social unease with unbridled eros, you know, a kind of as if the libido was weaker in them. And, you know, this is what I think we really have inherited, this assumption that, you know, male desire, you know, is just naturally more intense, you know, untrammeled, indiscriminate, but women bring this kind of order and restraint to it. So that was a positive, you know, if you like, narrative that women within Christian culture were given as their model, as their way to become exemplary, as their way to be special, distinct, and beautiful. And then they were given, you know, images probably from a different tradition, which I talk about in the book, the pastoral tradition, that women are, you know, sweeter, more gentle, more removed from the cut and thrust of, you know, both commercial life and military life. And they can be this retreat. They can be this kind of idyllic place where men go to relax and get away from, you know, from the force and competition and, you know, rivalry of regular life. So the virgin there becomes something, you know, both magical for her very sweetness and her childlikeness. So this other idealization of the virgin as kind of the survival of the child has played a pretty strong part in this culture of valuing chastity.
Within that pastoral aesthetic, is the goal of virginity still spiritual exaltation?
Ooh.
Or is it more secular? Is it more about marriage and being a valuable, like a desirable object for marriage?
Yeah, that's I suppose is the lament of my book in a way. If it has a regret, it's the decline of the sacred, ambitious aspect of chastity in favor of this, you know, more accommodating, more passive association of chastity with modesty, with a kind of unknowing innocence that could be, you know, could be ideal femininity, that the woman never, you know, never grew up to the same extent. And that would never have been part of the original Christian message. That I think you can, if you're going to blame somebody, you can't blame St. Augustine and St. Paul. It's a secular ideal, and if you like, an ancient myth.
How has that ideal been reinforced throughout literature, in medieval literature or modern literature?
You get those these chivalric romances, all these stories about knights whose purpose in life is to go save virgins, and virgins somehow have gotten lost. They're wandering around in the woods, or they're potential victims of predators and brutal types, or indeed of monsters and non-human aggressors. And knightly virtue is to both respecting the purity of virginity, but having this great satisfaction of being able to save these innocent childlike women, and to protect them from perhaps their own sexuality as well as anything else. So I think the medieval literature kind of loves this notion of the magical, the virgin who's the only person who can catch the unicorn. The virgin is the person who can walk through, this, enchanted, diabolical world, and remain intact, kind of remain just exactly what she is and nothing else. So there's a kind of integrity there, which is the positive side of that, and goes along also with the way, medieval, romantic mythology tried to turn the sublimation of erotic love into a virtue for men as well. That if you desire, if your beloved is somebody you can never have, sort of in some ways remains this, untouchable virgin, then you can become stronger. You can prove yourself in both, having the adoration, having the worship, having the passion, but saying no to it, learning a kind of renunciation through erotic attachment. So the woman remains desirable, beautiful, perfect. We maintain the objectification of the female body and female sexuality, but it turns out to be a complement to the men who can look on this and yet say no to themselves, say no to their desire. So that kind of, almost a secular sort of asceticism becomes part of a literary tradition.
Do you feel like that serves to even further abstract women's sexuality? Because it's not something that, it becomes something that's not even, it doesn't even have any solidity to it. Like, it's not like it's something that women are either denying to their suitors or like overwhelming them with. It's something that is never even going to come about. The males, the chivalrous males, never get to come in contact with the females. And the more elusive or aloof or unattainable a female is in these stories, the more valuable she is.
Yeah, no, I think that's left a quite disturbing legacy. I mean, if you like, the double standard, or the virgin whore correlation that we've suffered with a lot is part of it. And you put that very well. I think it's an abstraction. It's an ideal of disembodiment at the same time that this is kind of highly endowed with sexual allure. Right, so that the allure is that which can't be touched, the allure which is that which is unattainable, but that is no action on the part of the woman. I mean, the woman is just to remain in her tower, or surrounded by like Sleeping Beauty, surrounded by these thorny bushes, and that the ideal moment is when the desiring male is kept away from this possible consummation. That there's always something disappointing, a letdown, a kind of return to normalcy about consummation. Then where is the ideal woman after that? So you want to put it off as long as possible, and you want to be, it's like then the kind of male erotic plot, or the kind of traditional erotic plot, is this step by step, refusal that perhaps at the end there will be, a condescension, an assent, a consent, but that you want to prolong, the seductiveness of that, so that women are valued, even if they're not quite believed, if they go on saying no. And that's a problem. And that's a problem that I'm trying to look at now I'm turning from chastity to doing some work on rape, and particularly on unconscious rape, to find out why the woman's power to say no is both idolized and indeed fetishized, and yet never taken seriously, never totally believed.
That's fascinating. Never thought about it like that. Okay, so I see that we are actually running out of time. So I have one more question, which is that, and this is something you touched on in the introduction to your book, actually, which is that there's a modern distaste for making any moral judgments about the sexual practices of women. You didn't exactly put it like that, and I don't know if that's exactly what you mean, but that's in my experience that is true. And we never want to say that there's one way of being sexual that's better than another in modern feminist discourse.
Yes.
That's obviously liberating and allows for more plurality of experience, which is a really good thing, but it also might leave us without any guidance and without any alternative structure. And so I could see how sexual practices without any imposing structure on them might fall into the patriarchal structure that is already dominance, that's already dominant. Should there be more intervention into the erotic lives of citizens?
Yeah, so this gets to a whole mess about the private and the public, which was something that, you know, to give them credit, I think early Christians, you know, managed their own solution to it. I do think there's a problem about the lack of sexual ethics today. And so, you know, maybe, you know, the book is, you know, only starts to be an intervention in that and in reminding us that there have been other ways of conceiving sexual ethics, even though they had, I suspect, their own kind of, you know, innate decline, you know, innate destiny to become ambivalent, paradoxical, impossible. But we haven't come up with anything better. We still have this awkwardness, uncertainty within feminism. Can you be just sex positive? Is it all great? Does everybody have a right to sex? And then where does that lead to you? Certainly, where does it lead to you in questions about, you know, sexual harassment, you know, assault, objectification of women, you know, even that kind of, you know, vulgarization of the conversation about sex? Because we are, you know, we are kind of, you know, anxious and kind of queasy about the very idea of trying to think morality and sex in the same moment. And feminism, you know, first it thought it had an answer. Yes, you know, we'd get rid of sexual repression and then we're going to be equal. But there is also another trend in you know, some of the early feminists who saw marriage as the real problem and saw almost as women's life with men as the beginning of corruption, and did try to separate themselves out. And we have, you know, have separatist feminism. We have, you know, an idealization of women love as perhaps the alternative to this mess. But we haven't thought of, you know, what's a sexual ethic for adults. Not, you know, not about children, you know, not about predators, not about, you know, the worst vices we can imagine, but for those of us who just stumble along, you know, kind of unclear about what you know could and should be a decent way to behave sexually. Right. And it's not that easily solved.
Totally. Well, thank you so much. This is so interesting. Is there anything quickly, I see we have a little more time, anything before we go that we should look out for?
in the present. I don't predict a revival of sexual chastity or any kind of chastity. It would be interesting if in our, you know, in our discussions about, you know, a world beyond gender and a world beyond binary gender, if some of these, you know, more ancient traditions and images return. I think, you know, the cult of Artemis has a certain appeal. I mean, this wild and you know, a kind of very destructive goddess, you know, because virginity can also be very violent. That has a sort of force that might be used, you know, against the, you know, the condescension to sexual virtue as something only for those who are afraid of sex, who are weak, who are inhibited. There are other ways to imagine you know, an independence from, you know, from the kind of imperative of sex. And I think that that may return. I don't think we're going to, we're not going to get away from a different responsibility for feminism, which is to fight, to defend, you know, women's control of their own sexuality. I don't think chastity is going, you know, is the right weapon, yeah, for that war. I don't know that I have a better one, but one kind of has to adapt to each new struggle. But I do look forward to, you know, one other thing is perhaps, you know, getting rid of this sort of blanket condemnation of the Christian tradition as, you know, the villain in the history of feminism and the villain in the history of sexuality. I think Foucault has helped a bit to make us see that differently, especially like in the last couple of volumes of his History of Sexuality. And also the Greco-Roman notions of temperance, of self-ownership, a kind of more contemplative attitude toward sexuality, where sexuality is not just considered something, you know, wild or bestial, but something that, you know, is part of life, but you know, not the be-all and end-all. So if I had to if I had to look positively at the next step for, you know, feminist critics and scholars and activists, it might also include, you know, rethinking our cultural past in the history of sexuality.
Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you. Very nice to talk to you.